Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We are opening this hour with a conversation with our friend Doug Keck of EWTN. He tells us more today about how EWTN is going to be airing the Mass celebrating the closing session for the cause of the five Shreveport martyrs. Now, Doug has been on the air to talk about this before with us. This is a story which is chronicled in the EWTN documentary, The Five Priests. Doug wants to talk to us about them. He wants to detail some stories of their lives with them. But he's also going to tell us about the Mass that closes the session for the cause of their canonization. So as we move along, this full-length documentary about these five French-born priests will show us how men can truly choose Christ and give their lives to minister to the sick. And by the way, these men did this during the devastating and indescribable yellow fever epidemic that struck Louisiana in 1873. The series itself premieres on October the 8th on EWTN. Now, we want to continue. Sorry, it premiered last year on October the 8th on EWTN. We want to continue this conversation to talk about the fact that schools are opening again. As kids head back to school, the debate over school choice continues to intensify, and this is disappointing because parents who are dissatisfied with school options are continuing to advocate real choices, no matter what the political and social controversy might be. And frankly, one would think that this is an issue that shouldn't be up for debate. Even in terms of natural law, long before you consider the teachings of the Catholic Church, it is completely within the purview of a parent to decide how best to educate their child based on the convictions, including and especially the faith that is held, the principles that are lived in the home by the parents. And the state has no right to stand in the way of that. And if anything, what the state ought to do is to become a facilitator in parents flourishing in parenting so that families can flourish, because that's how governments and societies flourish. So we talk about that with Dixie Lane. And finally, you speak with Dr. Deborah Savage about rethinking Pope St. John Paul II's call for what he termed as a new feminism. All this after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, August 25th. It's the feast of St. Louis IX, King of France. And today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. The Kremlin is quashing any hope the war in Ukraine will end anytime soon. Appearing on NBC's Meet the Press, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said there is no meeting planned between President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Lavrov said key issues including security guarantees and territorial disputes have yet to be resolved. President Trump has signed an executive order that looks to put an end to cashless bail across the country. The order threatens to withhold federal funding if cities do not end the policy. Trump said crime went up when cashless bails began. He also signed a separate order focused on the practice in Washington, D.C. The Menendez brothers won't be getting out of prison for now. A San Diego patrol board issued its decision on Lyle Friday night, a day after his brother Eric was also denied. 3 months ago, the brothers were resentenced to 50 years to life for the 1989 shotgun murders of their parents in their Beverly Hills home. And Cracker Barrel is hoping to see stock prices rebound after the hit it took when the popular restaurant chain unveiled a new logo. The revamped logo offers a simple design that removes the old man and carefully sketched barrel, but fans of the restaurant quickly rebuked the change. Cracker Barrel's new design resulted in a $100 million loss at one point last week. Despite widespread criticism and economic uncertainty, the company has not signaled that it will return to the original design. From the Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. On Thursday, this coming Thursday, EWTN will air the Mass celebrating the closing session for the cause of the five Shreveport martyrs. This is a story which is chronicled in the EWTN documentary, The Five Priests. Doug Keck joined us last year to talk about this, and he joins us again to talk about this issue. Doug is former president and COO of EWTN. Doug, it's great to speak with you. How are you?
Good, good. Thank you for having me back on. Hopefully I can add some insights.
Well, you did a tremendous job with talking about the series last year, and you mm-hmm. clearly show a passion for their life and what they did. So I'd like to begin with asking you to remind everyone about the series, the production, the beauty behind it, and all of those details.
Right, exactly. The Five Priests, as it's called, will be airing on Thursday the 28th. At 2 p.m., and that's after the closing session for the canonization closing session discussion. So we're excited about that. Obviously, they're American martyrs, quote-unquote, but martyrs understood in kind of a different way, kind of as Pope Francis put it, the idea of not someone who necessarily was killed because they were standing there saying, you know, well, I won't convert, I'm a Catholic for life, but someone who, quote-unquote, offered their life, you know, for some other purpose, for their brother, so to speak. And in this case, basically, were five Catholic priests in Shreveport, all who had originally come over as missionaries from France, taking on the hardships and understanding what it was like, and who decided to stay with their people and do what they could to help them medically and certainly spiritually and sacramentally. And over that period of 3 weeks or so, when many, many people died, they also died and basically gave up their lives really for their congregation, and yep. and in that way they certainly are martyrs of the faith, and that's kind of the way it's looked at. It's also been called the martyr to his charity at one time, and that was certainly something that Pope Francis has talked about. I think it's clear that Pope Leo, with some of the people he's talked about, has the same sense of that idea of looking at martyrdom in this kind of expanded sense.
And even as I'm remembering you share this, it truly was wonderful that their sheer bravery, their fortitude in the face of yellow fever, they wanted to make sure the needs of their flock were met long before concern about their own health was considered.
Absolutely, and it's the kind of thing that we think about it today. And I know some people who in retrospect have looked at this and said, how do we think of ourselves today compared to what they did, compared to what we did in 2020? Mm-hmm. Here they were willing to brave this disease to make sure that their people were taken care of sacramentally, along with, like I said, and spiritually and physically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were some questions, and I think there have been some rethinking over maybe the way the church responded during that time and that calamity and that pandemic, and you know, whether we should have opened up sooner and been a more available kind of a situation. Of course, everybody's a Monday morning quarterback. It's easy to say after the fact while you're going through it, but it's always great to see these great stories of people in the past and faith who were willing to do these things, because many times today, I mean, I always think of so many people who were asked, you know, with a machine gun to their head, are you a Catholic or a Christian, or, you know, and who were willing to say yes, knowing they were going to die. And how many people today would say, well, I could deny it, but in my heart, God knows what's true. So, you know, I don't have to really stand up for the faith, because God knows what's really going on in my heart, and this person's forcing me against my will, and lots of good reasons why not to stand up for the faith. And thank goodness most of aren't put in that position, but many of us are put today in a white martyred version of that. Really, the mother always talked about that idea of, you know, how many times are we compromising our principles in situations because we don't want to be exposed, or we don't want to be ridiculed, we don't want to be canceled, as it was going on for a lot of years.
That's right. And you consider that in light of the fact that these priests and seminarians Bishop Auguste Martin, when he went to get them from France, they knew what they were walking into. It's not like they came and things were good. They were going into yellow fever. They were unafraid of what was to befall them. Can you speak to that kind of selflessness that's hard to find today?
I guess I'd say I wish I could. I'm not sure, because I'm not sure how, you know, we're kind of, you know, they used to talk about limousine liberals. Some of us are couch potato Catholics, you know, I think, where, you know, we read all the prayers right and we show up for what we've got to do. But when the rubber hits the road, are we there? Are we willing to stand up and take on something that might put our comfortable lifestyle at risk? And I also think there's an aspect, too, that somehow a little bit has been diluted with when you get into kind of this universalist idea of salvation. You yep. start saying, well, everybody's kind of going to heaven anyway. So, I mean, it's nice to have the sacraments and it's kind of important, but it's not really life and death. Kind of a thing. And that certainly wasn't the way these types of missionaries would think about it, who risked their lives. And I always think of Isaac Jogues, and if somebody told him, you know, well, everybody, all the Indians are going to be saved anyway. You know, the indigenous people are going to be saved anyway. Would he have done the same thing? That's the question. And I think for sometimes in our world today, people are not being asked enough, per se, and I'm not talking about, you know, myself as if I am, that's for sure. But I mean, really, the idea of we figured out how to kind of make a club that we make the rules as easy as possible to get in so that we can get everybody in there, but there's no buy-in because at the end of the day, it didn't take anything to be a member.
Right.
And so is that prized? Is that cared about? And does somebody understand whether people like it or not? You know, there needs to be a downside to your actions.
Yep.
Otherwise, why change what you want to do? If at the end of the day, no matter what you're told is right or wrong, you can do all the wrong things, and in the end it works out okay, well, then why not do those things?
Yep, and therein lies the horrendous issue, because that kind of a worldview flies in the face of the sacrifice of these martyrs, because they came out to give the sacraments to the sick and the dying, knowing that they shouldn't die before receiving Jesus.
Absolutely, and that's the part that I think in overestimating the idea that listen, God can save everybody,
right,
everything all like that. But really, we're more like the ones who are told too much is given, much is expected.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember Carl Keating once said, "Don't worry about the other people who don't know about Jesus. God is going to understand their situation, but he's going to ask you, what did you do to make it so that they did know about Jesus? What did you do in your life to spread the gospel? What did you do in your life to take the gifts you were given as a Catholic and expand out on those?" As we know from the parable of the talents, the person who just takes the talent, I'm a Catholic and I live my good little life and I bury it in the backyard and I show up with that. Our Lord wasn't very happy with that. He expected you to do something more with it.
Right.
He wanted you to multiply it, and that's really evangelizing in your own life to your family, to your friends, to your neighbors. In any way possible, you can do it. And for some, it means going to faraway countries and being that. And, you know, it just doesn't mean helping people's bodies. It means their body and soul. We're not dualists. That's all combined together. You can't help people physically if you're not also helping them spiritually.
Yep, and that's precisely the lesson that we learn looking at the lives of the Shreveport martyrs. So, very quickly, tell us about the coverage of the Mass and the five priests that airs after.
Right, exactly. Well, the Mass itself is going to be happening basically in the afternoon on the 28th, around 5:30 or so. And then we've also got the Mass at Thursday the 28th at 2 p.m. Central Time. I might not have the time on the Mass exactly right, but check out EW10.com and have all the information about all these great events, and you can thank great people like John and Michael Elson who put something like this together.
Thank you so much, Doug, as always. My guest has been Doug Keck, host of EWTN Bookmark, President Emeritus and former COO of EWTN. We've been talking about the five priests, the Shreveport martyrs, and the airing of the Mass that closes the course for their canonization. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When I heard other business owners say they finally found someone in the credit card industry they can trust, I wondered how he could help me. So when Mark from Schisler CPC offered to show me where all the money goes for credit card processing with a free analysis of my business, I jumped on it. He reviewed how the industry works, where we could save, and offered a no-contract guarantee on savings and excellent customer service. I'm saving thousands of dollars a year. Schisler CPC. Trust in them.
More information available on the Ave Maria website under Sponsor Business Directory.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria, Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Marcus Peter. Ave Maria Radio spearheads the proclamation of the gospel into all areas of society and culture. And so we want to invite you to think about what Catholic radio means for you. Because our towers and our equipment need updating. And we want to ask you to think about the impact of Catholic radio and how your donations can help continue the propagation of the gospel for the salvation of souls to all who hear it. Thank you for joining us on this wondrous mission.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Arthur Speter. As children head back to school, the debate over school choice intensifies. Parents who are dissatisfied with school options are continuing to advocate real choices no matter what the political and social controversy. We look at this issue again with Dixie Lane. Dixie Dylan Lane is an American historian, associate editor at Hearth and Field, contributing editor at Front Porch Republic, and a mother of four. Dixie, it's great to speak with you. How are you?
Oh, I'm well, thank you. I'm delighted to speak with you, too.
I'm delighted to be able to talk about your very well-thought-out piece. And
oh, thank you.
I want to start by addressing the reality that school choice shouldn't be controversial, and yet it has been made so. Maybe let's start there, that it shouldn't be controversial, and to provide reasons as to why.
Well, I think from a historical point of view, schools have always been so important in our country. In the United States, we had literacy at high levels very early on and very early public schools, but those schools were almost always really carefully locally controlled by parents in the community. And children and families were always free to choose to study at home or to study under a tutor. There were always all sorts of different ways in learning in America, even as learning was very highly prized. So it really makes sense from a historical perspective that there would be different ways in America to go to school, and that would be something that our country would really instinctively understand.
And unfortunately, as you said, by virtue of natural law and, you know, some constitutional understanding especially, you would think that we would understand it, and yet it's become a hot-button topic. How did we allow that to happen?
Well, I think that with so many things, the real question comes down to money, and that's the case with this question. You know, I think that Americans have always been unsure whether the public should really fund any sort of religious education. And so even though our original common schools, you know, included prayer, included hymns, included readings from the Bible, usually the King James Version, so not from the Catholic Bible, you know, there was not a solid understanding or a shared belief about whether schools that taught a more specific faith or a different faith should be publicly funded.
Mm-hmm.
So while our sort of independent American mind usually did think that parents should have the right to, for example, send their children to a boarding school or a private school or have a tutor, the idea that taxpayers should fund that has just always been controversial. And at different times in history, really could have gone one way or the other.
More and more, as the years go by, it becomes very clear that the public schooling system, together with all of its progressivist ideologies and political leans, has become so entrenched that parents are hard-pressed for school choice. And in order to choose a school, very often it involves significant out-of-pocket expenses. And even programs like voucher programs, education savings accounts, they have a lot of bugs and create a lot of hoops to jump through.
Yes, that's quite true. And really, it brings up a good point, which is that when we talk about school choice, we're actually talking about two separate things.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about whether parents have the right to choose a particular education for their children, and then we're talking about who pays for it.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, in all states, you know, and ever since the landmark Supreme Court case in Oregon, the Pierce versus Society of Sisters in 1925, yeah, it's been pretty clear that a state cannot make a law that says all children must go to public school.
Mm-hmm.
But it's created sort of a problem for those who are trying to help support families through voucher systems or publicly funded ESAs, because there's this illusion of choice, right? There's this illusion, you know, you can go send your child to Catholic school, you can send your child to Hebrew school, you can send your child wherever, but you really can't do that unless you have the money. And the problem there is that the whole system is based on the idea that the public schools in general provide an adequate academic education in a safe environment, mm-hmm, for most children. And if they did, then that would be an adequate choice for most children. But since, generally speaking, they don't, parents find themselves with no choices that are really going to be adequate for their children.
It's unfortunate, really. Pierce versus Society of Sisters, like you mentioned, it was in 1925, and the Supreme Court made abundantly clear in the statement back then that the child is not the mere creature of the state, and that it is really those who raise and nurture the child and direct his destiny actually have the right and the high duty to prepare them for social obligations. That kind of a sentiment doesn't seem to drive policymaking and government political conversation pertaining to child education today.
I think that's probably true. I think we've seen over the 20th century sort of a long march toward school consolidation, mm-hmm, and toward sort of higher level control of schools. So, you know, teachers themselves have less control over what happens in their classroom, over which textbooks they use, even over which, you know, flyers they allow to be posted on their corkboards in their classrooms. So it's all directed from a higher level. But, you know, when you talk about something like Pierce versus Society of Sisters, those precedents can be used in such different ways. And in some court cases against homeschooling, for example, or adjudicating about homeschooling, that case has actually been used to bolster sort of the public's right to control education, because the decision also involved language that said that the state has the right to, in some ways, influence education, which, you know, is true in the sense that from a moral point of view, the public also has an interest in making sure that children aren't neglected. But we've drifted very far from our original understanding that primarily this was the parents' business, and that towns would get together and arrange for schools for those who wanted to go, to where now we think that really parents stand in the way of education, or that parents should be following the directives, mm-hmm, of educational experts. And those just really aren't always driven by an understanding of, yeah, child development or of teaching or of, you know, even a sort of, you know, forget religion, a sort of humanist view of,
that's
of
right,
children.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And unfortunately, as I keep tracking the newest educational philosophies and fads that are coming out about the newest way to successfully teach children, it becomes more and more clear that it's devoid of a realistic anthropology and devoid of a language of virtue and moral accountability and the common good.
Yes, and in some ways it's very hard for those who are interested in those things to be effective mm-hmm. in our public school systems. Now, our public schools are, of course, still much more locally controlled than they are in, say, France or Germany. You know, they're still run at the district level, but there's a lot of influence from the state and now more and more from the federal government. But, you know, there are public schools that serve children well. There are teachers who serve children well. But it's harder and harder for them to do so because they come up against policies and they come up against pressure tied to funding as well. And so they can't be creative. You know, in many cases, they aren't allowed to use any means of discipline, even the gentlest with the children. And it makes it very difficult to teach effectively. So, you know, those people who are in that system and are really loving children and educating them well are really doing something heroic, and we need to be able to support them better, but it's very, very hard to do that.
Yep. And considering all of that, public schools and the entire public school complex, so to speak, has been hemorrhaging funds and even numbers. And so there's a vested interest there to force the program to continue and therefore to deny parents the right to school choice.
That's right. Again, in some ways, it comes down to money. And mm-hmm. that doesn't mean your individual teacher is concerned about money, but that the people who are in control are. And, you know, in many, many states, the amount of money that goes to any particular school is directly related to how many students are enrolled there. So if you have a voucher system where a student can take that money and take it to a private school, then that public school is going to be losing funds.
Right. Well, Dixie, it was a real joy speaking with you. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
My guest has been Dixie Lane, who authored this great article in the Public Discourse, Why School Choice is So Controversial. She is an American historian and prolific author and editor. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them, so you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
I've had times in my life when I found it extremely difficult to forgive someone who I believe wronged me. Then I start to notice the anguish, anger, and pain in others who are holding on to past hurts, and I had an epiphany moment. I did not want to be one of them. Not only could they not forgive the hurt, but they also lamented over the situation for years. The old saying goes, holding on to anger is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. I started a new routine. I began to offer up the Eucharist at Mass to the person who hurt me the most. For several months, I offered it up to one person. Then for years, it was another, until I no longer felt anything negative about that person. I let the pain go, and I let God take over through the body and blood of Christ. I'm not sure what that prayer did for the other people I focused on during communion, but I do know it brought me peace. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denhagarmo, communications evangelist and host of Epiphany.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio.
Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Honey, did you ever call Mighty Dog Roofing of Ann Arbor for that free roof inspection?
I knew I forgot something.
Roof leaks can cause mold buildup or even roof collapse. Protect your family today by calling local Catholics Dan and Mary Flanagan at Mighty Dog Roofing for a free inspection of your roof, siding, or windows. Mighty Dog Roofing, 734-224-4916. That's 734-224-4916.
If you've noticed improved sound from 990 AM, you'd not only be correct, but you have yourselves to thank. Donors like you to our Strong Towers Foundation is allowing us to make some improvements. Ave Maria Radio has a lot to go, but we wanted to thank you and share the small victories so that we can continue to transform lives while offering hope, guidance, and truth to all those that are searching.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Pope St. John Paul II had a famous declaration in his 1995 encyclical, Evangelium Vitae. Essentially, he proclaimed that it was up to women to promote a new feminism. Now, that phrase was met with tremendous surprise in some circles. Many were excited, and some others were perturbed. The feminine genius had become practically a household word by that point, and the message to women could not have come at a more fitting moment in the history of the feminist movement. Now, what does this message mean today? Dr. Deborah Savage joins us to talk about this. Dr. Deborah Savage is professor of theology at Franciscan University of Steubenville. She also serves as the director of the Institute for the Study of Man and Woman and received her doctorate in religious studies from Marquette in 2005. Deborah, great to speak with you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
So, I think it's important we begin by addressing the historical milieu that John Paul II had entered into and was writing in, the messages that were given to women and what had happened to the social view of womanhood.
Yeah. Well, the church always responds to questions of every era, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's been true throughout history. Another thing that's been true throughout history is that Christianity as a whole has elevated the status of women throughout the world, really. Jesus was countercultural in that he spoke with women and ate with them and invited them into his circle. So we have a lot to go on there. But then, as everyone knows, there was the start of the feminist movement in the 1900s and beyond took us in a more radical direction. Women had felt that they were mistreated, and we have to also admit that mistakes were made.
Right.
But in reaction to that, it became sort of a power struggle between men and women. Of course, now women kind of think that they have to act like men in order to be considered human.
Mm-hmm.
The male is a normative for the species. This has been an undercurrent of our tradition since Aristotle. So I kind of have to chuckle because they really don't know that they're fighting with the wrong thing. You know, women have their own voice and their own place in the created order. They're not above man. They're not below him. What I like to say is that without man, woman has no place. But without woman, man has no future.
Mm-hmm. And
so take your pick.
Right, and that really becomes a foundational framework for the way men and women ought to be viewing each other. In fact, this competitive model that second wave and eventually third wave feminism pushed forth has done more to harm women than liberate and enable women.
No, that's absolutely true. And frankly, we're now systematically undermining the men as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much talk about women and so much concern about their rights. And if you just even watch the average television show and there's commercials scattered throughout, you can be sure you're going to see a commercial in which the man is ridiculed. And women are now the heroes, and even in action movies, it's so, you know, those are silly examples, but their culture is downstream of these things, you know, and it reveals quite a bit about where things are at. So the data is really clear. Men are really unsure of what they're supposed to be doing. They think, and they're right, that who they really are is not actually wanted anymore. And it's just, it, to me, the devil, the evil one, started with women, and he dismantled them. They lost their place, and now men are losing theirs. And it's just part of the systematic destruction of a human person that's been underway for such a long time.
Yeah.
And, of course, the evil one gets us right where it counts, right at the center of human experience.
Mm-hmm. And one of the core realities of that human experience when one just observes nature in reality is the dual reality of womanhood and manhood and how complementary that is designed to be.
Oh, and, very clear.
And so John Paul is standing as a polemic against the polemic in that sense. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, he, as I say in my article, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, we haven't mentioned that. There's an article, but what's true is that John Paul only spoke about feminism in any formal way once, and that was in number 99 of Evangelium Vitae, where you quoted that at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
He never spoke of it again, except for one public speech that he gave in which he quoted himself. But what I think, if you look at it, is that especially the first decade of his papacy, he didn't mean for us to redefine feminism per se. If you look at the body of work that led up to that, it's very clear from his writing that he says, and he says this more often, frequently, so did the Synod of Bishops on the vocation of the lady say, that if women are to find their place in the world and in the church, what's needed, and the church is 100% behind that, very much in support mm-hmm. of it, we need their voices, it's clear. What's needed, he says, is a deeper analysis, a deeper investigation of the meaning of masculinity and femininity. And I've been working on the man-woman question for 15 years. When the feminine genius became popular, I would get asked to speak about that. And then at a certain point, I got uncomfortable with it because it started to turn it into its sort of own strange version of a Catholic feminism where we sit around and talk about how dumb our husbands were.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, I said, I won't speak about that anymore. And I turned my attention to the effort to discern a masculine genius. And I did derive one from the created order, from the account in Genesis 2. Men have a genius. And it's worth mentioning that the last document that he wrote not the last one, but the last one of prominence in this regard was in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
It was Redemptoris Custos,
mm-hmm.
Joseph's, his letter on Joseph.
Yep.
And he published that on August 15th, 1989, 1 year to the day after he published Mulieris Dignitatem. And then in 1990, he's on to the social question. So the first decade of his papacy was all ordered toward an exploration of man and woman, starting with the theology of the body, and then from then on. So he had an agenda. It's very clear. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows that about him. His project is so coherent and synthesized and integrated. He had an agenda when he came into the papacy, And he completed that the best he could by 1989. His next encyclical is Redemptoris Missio.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, it's Centesimus Annus in 1991. So what I realized as I was investigating this is that this was the intelligence of the CIA sense that we should have brought to his question.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't, you know, and as I, one thing that's helpful is to realize that really throughout history, thinkers in every tradition, but certainly in the West, have been caught in the same trap over and over again. They allow their interlocutors or their opponents to set the terms of the debate. Very true,
right,
during the Enlightenment period. And that's, I think, I'm trying to argue with the women or whoever's listening that we made that mistake too.
Deborah, I'm really glad we're having this conversation. I'm talking with Dr. Deborah Savage. She's a professor of theology at Franciscan University of Steubenville. She recently penned an article called Rethinking Pope St. John Paul II's Call for a New Feminism, published on Catholic World Report. And that's what we're talking about. What did John Paul II mean? How ought we to think about it and reclaim the notion of women in the social sphere? Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Ray Guerindi here. As a father who has helped homeschool my 10 children, I know the challenges you face. That's why you should check out Sylvan Learning Centers for personalized support tailored to your child's unique needs. Expert tutors in math, reading, and writing provide fun, interactive lessons with both in-person and online options that fit seamlessly into your homeschooling routine.
Visit sylvanlearning.com. Mention Dr. Ray for 10% off at participating centers.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
On the next Epiphany.
Hi, Vanessa Dunn-Hagarmo here. It's time for the next installment of the Epiphany Book Club. I'll be joined by Adora Kassab Ibrahim and Monsignor Stephen Rossetti to discuss his book, My Confrontation with Hell, Real Demonic Encounters of an Exorcist. The book is a testament to the enduring power of faith in the face of unimaginable evil.
Epiphany, weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
How best to express ourselves to God? Our prayer takes flesh, says the Catholic Catechism, when we use mental or vocal words to talk to God, who speaks to us through His Word. Our heart must be involved in prayer. We must be present to Him whom we are addressing. Whether or not our prayer is heard depends not on the number of our words, says St. John Chrysostom, as the fervor of our souls. Vocal prayer is essential to the Christian life. Jesus taught the perfect vocal prayer, the Our Father, to his disciples. He prayed aloud the liturgical prayers in the synagogue. He also prayed aloud personally, exultantly praising the Father as well as expressing his agony in Gethsemane. Vocal prayer fits the needs of our human nature. We are body and spirit, and this need corresponds to a divine requirement. God seeks worshipers in truth and spirit. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes, without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, speaking with Dr. Deborah Savage, Professor of Theology at Franciscan University of Steubenville. Deborah, I want to pick up where we had just left off, like you were mentioning, about the battle John Paul II was facing in terms of attacks on womanhood, but also on manhood. And so, like you mentioned, you know, presenting a genius of how to think about feminism rightly, and what is this new feminism John Paul proposed?
Yeah. Well, my argument would be that we need to get outside of that box. That's the terms of the debate set for us by the culture. You have your own definition of feminism, I have mine. And that one of the clues that we're on the wrong path there is that whenever you use that term, you have to define it. Well, I don't mean that kind of feminism. I mean this kind of feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm suggesting in my work and to whomever will listen to me is that the real question is, who is woman?
Mm-hmm.
And when you open the question up like that, it becomes much more, much deeper, much more profound study. The church articulates the question we face this way, and it's in the working documents of the Synod on the Vocation of the Laity, 1987. Mm-hmm. The bishops ask, why is it that God made us male and female?
Right.
And what are the consequences of that decision? What does it mean? Why are we man and woman? And what does that mean for our work in the world? So, when Pope Francis, God bless him and God rest his soul, said we need a theology of women, I immediately wrote, no, we don't. We need a theology of complementarity.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that would have to be grounded in a robust account of the nature of woman, the nature of man. And the problem is you can't understand either one of them except in relation to each other. You can't really understand woman apart from man or vice versa. She has an identity, as does he. But that identity is ordered toward the other. We're made for relationship. There's not a moment in my life when I'm not called to be in relationship with someone, with God, or with my friends, or with my spouse. So, you know, you have to account for that. It doesn't mean she doesn't have her own identity, as I said, but it's going to be an identity that is naturally, of necessity, have a relational component. So I agree completely with John Paul that woman is oriented toward person. This is evident in the neuroscience. It's evident sociologically. It's evident in all sorts of ways. And I argue that the origin of that is in the creation account in Genesis 2. It's not until woman appears that Adam knows who she is, who he is, I mean. He doesn't really know what he's there for. Why do I have these gifts? Yes, I can till and weed the garden, but for what? And when woman appears, he now understands that his gifts are to be put at her service. And and she reveals him to himself. She looks into his eyes. My argument is they both had a distinct preternatural gift, and following Aquinas there,
Mm-hmm.
that's probably more than anyone wants to listen to right now. But she was able to, the woman is able to see into the being of persons. And man's genius is found in the fact that he was able to see into the nature of the created order. He named all the animals.
Right.
And he has this incredible capacity for understanding and sort of categorizing the world, putting it in order, understanding genus and species, for example, and their capacity for the way men think, again, evident in the neuroscience, is really what equipped them to branch out and create taxonomies of all sorts in biology, in the law, in theology, in philosophy. There's just so much evidence of that. And we are desperately in need of resurrecting our understanding of who man is, because they're the ones that have sustained civilization for centuries through their work, through their protective cover, through their gift of themselves. Yeah. So, but I guess one last point I want to make there is that it's not until woman appears that human community enters into human history. So again, the Hebrew in the Genesis account is very clear that the first person, if you will, was a male.
Mm-hmm.
That requires a lot of unpacking. But when woman comes out of his rib, this is so essential, because that means that we're organically connected. We are absolutely organically connected for our whole lives, really, just in general. If it weren't for that fact, the sexual union that constitutes the gift of self would be only an external kind of thing. It would be two bodies oriented toward each other, coming together, and that would be great. But the fact that the woman is made out of Adam's rib is so profoundly important. It doesn't mean she's second and created and inferior. It means she actually comes out of the unity prefigured in Adam. And that has to do with the way the Semitic author would have understood personhood and the soul. So I'm really very excited about the things I've discovered, but I should add that they weren't my discoveries. There's no way I would have figured that stuff out. I think they were really little hints that I was, I don't know, for whatever reason, hearing. And the more I dug into it, the more I saw that the Genesis accounts are really, they have unbelievable depths. It might be true that as a woman theologian, I brought different questions to the text. But, maybe I should stop there. Don't let me go on and on.
Well, no, Deborah, I appreciated that, because I'm a scripture scholar, and the first few pages of Genesis form the heart of the covenant theology I do. And I've got a very intimate understanding of how the Hebrew interplay between maleness and femaleness shows up in those first few pages. And so considering that, when John Paul II utilizes that term new feminism, he isn't calling for a novel approach that the church has to take. He's calling for a reclamation of that which is classical and true. And so, like you mentioned, we don't need a new theology for women or for men. What we need is a theology of the human person, complementarity. And in a lot of ways, the theology of the body becomes that.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's true. John Paul provided us with all sorts of clues. You kind of have to extract them, but it's all right there. But I argue, and I think he would agree, that the project is far from over.
Yep.
He didn't really treat explicitly the masculine genius, though the letter on Joseph gives us a good starting place. But so there's much more work to be done, and it needs to be brought into the public eye in a way that can be digested and understood. And there's been some wonderful work done on that. So, but again, no scholar can do everything. And I have the feeling he's up there, you know, applauding me. At least I've been praying to him since before he was canonized. I finished my chapter on him in my dissertation the day before he died. And he was just, I miss him. I still miss him. So, anyway, I'm trying to, it's a sort of a creative development project, I'd say. He's the place I start. In fact, it's John Paul in the first audiences two and three.
Mm-hmm.
He says the first account of Genesis is about man in the objective sense.
Mm-hmm.
And the second account of Genesis is about man in the subjective sense, the psychological sense. And I thought that was such an interesting claim. But then in the seventh audience, he says, I'm not going to bother with that stuff. So I said, okay, I'll figure it out. And that's what got me started. And he's right. He's absolutely right about that. I think, anyway.
Yeah, well,
so
I share that in common with you.
Okay. Wow.
That's now,
good to know.
Well, I want to go back to, therefore, this language of recapturing, especially from a societal perspective, the position and understanding of womanhood. It's not like we need to therefore become antagonistically polemical. What you're saying is man and woman ought to live the fullness of the maleness and femaleness in virtue and holiness. And that's what's going to transform understanding and culture.
Absolutely, yeah. I would say we haven't really even yet heard the voice of woman proclaimed very loudly, because women like me, I'm not saying I have all the answers and everyone should just stop and listen to me, only that women, faithful women who really do have a question about what it means to be a woman, they're often overshadowed by all the shouting, by all the going back and forth about what kind of feminism should we have? You know, what are women's rights?
Right.
The fact that they have to bear children, isn't that unfair?
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah, Deborah, I know we could go on. Thank you so much for making the time.
Oh, yes, you're welcome. Thank you. It's a privilege.
My guest has been Dr. Deborah Savage, professor of theology at Franciscan University of Steubenville. We've been talking about John Paul II's call for us to reclaim the meaning of womanhood in light of God's plan. I'm Marcus Peter.